Today's guest says that stigma breeds shame. Stigma breeds silence. We'll find out why in just a moment. Hello, everyone. My name is Pamela Brewer, welcoming you to this edition of Mind Talk. Today's guest, Dr. Stephen P. Hinshaw, is a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley and a professor of psychiatry at UC San Francisco. Dr. Hinshaw is very busy. He's the author of 12 books, and his research in clinical and developmental psychology have netted him several awards. He has been well covered by the major publications of our time, so I am indeed very pleased to have him here with us at Mind Talk. Dr. Hinshaw, welcome.
Well, I'm delighted to be on, and thanks so much.
Now, Dr. Hinshaw, you begin your story, which you have entitled Another Kind of Madness, which has been noted as a masterpiece as well by some of your reviewers, Glenn Close in particular, who I think is a name that many people will recognize. But you took your title from someone who you have noted as having created a masterpiece. And I'm wondering if you would share the quote for the audience that you have in your book.
Let me read from the book's preface. The inspiration for this book's title comes from a quote from James Baldwin in one of his masterpieces, Giovanni's Room. Quote, "People who remember court madness through pain, the pain of the perpetually recurring death of their innocence. People who forget court another kind of madness, the madness of the denial of pain, and the hatred of innocence. And the world is mostly divided between madmen who remember and madmen who forget." So that's the quote.
It's a powerful quote. And, you know, one of the things that's, thank you for sharing that with us, Dr. Hinshaw. One of the things that strikes me just right off the bat is that many lay people have the notion that if you are an accomplished clinician, that your life has just sort of, you know, been created out of a golden bubble and you have gone along swimmingly and there has been no crisis in your life. And just the fact that you have been willing to share your own personal story, I think, is powerful in and of itself. You begin Another Kind of Madness, which is subtitled A Journey Through the Stigma and Hope of Mental Illness, talking about your childhood and talking about your interactions with your dad. Can you tell us about a Sunday dinner that you describe in some detail that was about to happen at a restaurant that was to be a traditional family meal? And then that particular Sunday, it seemed like everything fell apart very quickly.
So here we were in Columbus, Ohio. My dad was a philosopher, professor of philosophy at OSU, very promising. He had been, while a graduate student at Princeton, had a weekly tutorial with Bertrand Russell on sabbatical over from England. Later in his graduate career, got to know Albert Einstein across the street at the Institute for Advanced Study and wrote a chapter on Einstein's social and moral philosophy. Became a professor at OSU, met my mother, grad student in history. They fell in love. We went to OSU football games. Dad had been on the faculty for a few years, and we had 50-yard line seats. My little sister and I had the benefits of a very warm academic family in the Midwest. What could have been better? Well, sometimes mysteries happened. So on this particular Sunday after church, we drove across town, across Columbus, to my grandmother's, my mother's mother's home. And as we would do every month or so, we headed out to the Willard with its tempting mashed potatoes and fried chicken dinners. And I always look forward to those Sunday afternoons. But on this particular Sunday, I was probably in first grade. My sister was about to enter kindergarten, and just driving across town, this is before you could take the freeway and save 15 minutes, going through downtown Columbus by the state capitol, try to describe the scene as vividly as I can, Dad seems elevated in the driver's seat of our station wagon by a couple of feet, as though he were on some kind of invisible perch. He seemed superior. He seemed to know everything, and the snarl on his face and the edge in his voice, I couldn't remember seeing or hearing Dad quite like that. We got out to the restaurant, and I was clutching the car seat with my knuckles, wondering maybe this would pass, maybe Dad's in a bad mood. And we got out to the Willard, but we got there a little bit late, and there was a huge line. I've never been the world's most patient individual, and it was getting hot on a spring day, and I was itchy in my sweater, and I couldn't stand to wait, and I was getting angry, and then Dad lost it. Shooed my sister and me over to the car. Grandmother and Mom cowered behind, and almost as though he were awaiting something horrible happening, he drove us back to Grandmother's house and then unloaded on her in the kitchen. If you hadn't spoiled the children so badly when they would spend the night out here, Stephen would have never acted like this. And Mom burst into tears, and I thought, what has happened? My dad's a philosopher. I knew that from the time I was very little. He's calm and measured. What, of course, I didn't know at the time is that he was fast escalating into an episode of mania. Wasn't sleeping, wake up early, write incomprehensible scrawls on his legal pads, thought he'd solve the world's and the universe's philosophical problems. He'd started at age 16 out in Southern California with his first episode like this, coming to the belief that if he just lifted his arms up, they'd become wings and he could fly. This is back in the mid-30s. He thought that he was the savior of Earth, placed on the planet to stop the growing fascist threat, to stop Hitler and Mussolini. And in the middle of the night in Pasadena, wandering the streets, how would he enact his plan? Came upon the idea that if he just made this magnificent flight, the world's leaders would notice and the free world would stop the fascists, and climbed up the trellis before dawn and made his first flight. Of course, it was a second and a half from the roof of the home to the ground below, survived somehow this very psychotic half-suicide attempt, half-attempting to save the world, and was in a back ward of a state mental hospital in Southern California for 6 months, essentially given up for dead. So Dad's life was marked by brilliance. There were six boys in the family, and they were all quite accomplished, or, in the vernacular, madness. Another kind of madness, quoting from Baldwin again, isn't the bipolar disorder he had, misdiagnosed as schizophrenia for 40 years until I diagnosed it correctly. The madness was when he got home at age 16, now 17, from the hospital, the family never talked about it because they didn't know what had happened. Dad's later episodes, and there were many of them, when he was a professor, my sister and I were young, he asked his doctor, what do I tell my children about my hospitalizations and my supposed schizophrenia? And the lead doctor said, if your children ever learn the reason for your disappearances, they'll be permanently destroyed. You and your wife are forbidden from ever discussing it.
Extraordinary.
So the madness is the shame and the silence. What do kids do when they know something's going wrong at home but nobody's talking about it? They tend to blame themselves.
Absolutely.
This internalization. And so the depressions I've had in my life, I'm sure, are partly related to the bipolar genes, depression genes that Dad transmitted, but also to the shame and silence. It wasn't until I was 18, home from back east, my first spring break from college, Dad pulled me into study and said, son, perhaps you should learn something of my life. I think he reasoned that I wasn't a child anymore, so he wasn't disobeying the doctor's orders. My life changed then once I started to learn the truth.
Your description of your dad brings up so many questions, as I'm sure you can understand. One of the things that comes immediately to mind is, of course, you know, there are so many myths about mental illness, even today as we speak. And one of them is that if you have a mental illness label, it means that you are fully and completely incapacitated, that you cannot do anything, that your mind doesn't function really at all. And so to hear you talk about your father, who was extremely well accomplished, who was intellectually gifted, who was doing wonderful things with his career, Russell, Einstein, you know, it almost doesn't get a whole lot better than that, and a lot more impressive than that. It really sort of bursts a bubble, I think an important bubble, in the eyes of so many people who see mental illness so incorrectly.
Mental illness still stereotypically in the folklore, in too much of the media, is it's permanent, it's irreversible, you're completely either violent or incompetent. People with serious mental illness are five times more likely to be victimized by violence than other people, except in rare cases, no more likely to commit violence, except what's the public face of mental illness too much? The school shooters, the disgruntled men who look deranged. And now, if you have a psychotic illness and you believe people are out to control you, what we call a delusion of control, an extreme paranoid delusion, you may preemptively become violent. But with treatment, those symptoms go away. The ultimate paradox, to me, of the shame and silence and stigma is that even though we don't have cures yet, the science is progressing, but we don't have cures yet. If you go to your doctor, psychiatrist, psychologist, social worker, for treatment for moderate to severe mental illness, whether through medication, if you have a severe form, most often through individual or group or family therapy, there's many evidence-based forms of such, recovery is a distinct possibility. The average effect on symptoms and impairments of getting good mental health treatments is bigger, typically, than the average treatment size, effect size you'll get from seeing your doctor for a physical illness you may have. The myth of permanence and incompetence is simply wrong. Most people with mental illness can recover. They can lead fully productive lives if only they can get access to treatment. So here's a statistic. Our colleague Ron Kessler, the great epidemiologist at Harvard School of Public Health, has done national surveys. And what's the average length of time now, 21st century, for people with mental illnesses between the time they recognize, you know, maybe these symptoms are, maybe things aren't going well, I should get this evaluated, and getting a formal assessment and treatment? The mean, the average is 10 years.
Wow.
For something like OCD, it's 17 years. These are crucial years, often in your teens or early 20s, when early detection and treatment could make a big difference. But the shame and sometimes ignorance and stigma and lack of parity for mental health care deprive people of the treatments they need, so the vicious cycle continues.
There's another piece that you mentioned, and I want to come back to what you just said in terms of getting proper treatment. But you also talked about your dad taking sort of attempting to take flight off the top of the building. And, you know, for the clinicians who listen to the program, I wanted you to talk more about this, the importance of really exploring behaviors and not assuming that a particular behavior is a particular evidence of a particular diagnosis without getting more information. Anyone sort of fresh out of school might say he took a flying leap off a building. He was trying to kill himself. But in fact, as you described it, he wasn't trying to kill himself. He was having a psychotic episode and he was trying to save the world. Huge difference.
He was trying. He was clearly delusional. So back in the day, most of the last century, if you had hallucinations, hearing voices, etc., having very strong fixed belief delusions. It was automatically assumed you had schizophrenia. Of course, those are symptoms of schizophrenia. But if you have a severe enough manic episode or even a severe enough depression, those kinds of psychotic features and thinking and beliefs will come into play. So the behavior was he climbed up the trellis of the family home in Pasadena. The sun was just coming up. He thought the world's leaders could only witness his flight once the sun was up, forgetting different time zones around the world. And again, objectively, you'd say, suicide attempt. In fact, he thought he was that far gone in his manic delusional state that he was actually saving the free world. And so, number one, getting behind, just as you put it, the behavior to its intent and what it means for the person is crucial. Number two, if the doctors had known back then that this was part of a bipolar, what used to be called manic depressive illness, and that it's in fact the case that many people who escalate fast into mania, you don't just get happy, you don't just get grandiose, you start to get irritable, you start to believe that you're the savior of the planet, and it looks like schizophrenia at the time, but what we now know is mood-stabilizing medications that are pretty particular for bipolar disorder can stop those cycles in their tracks often, and often it takes a lot of support for a person to stay on medication, and when the person's out of that cycle, cognitive behavior therapy, group support, family therapy can reinforce for everybody the need to recognize you've got this form of mental illness, you need to stay in treatment. When we do that, we don't just treat the symptoms, we treat the whole person and the family and the groups that the person lives in. This is the essence. Now, other part of my career is working with kids with learning and attention problems, ADHD in particular. I'm worried that many kids are getting still underdiagnosed, but I'm also worried that kids are getting overdiagnosed, partly because too many diagnoses, quote-unquote, are made in a 10 to 15-minute office visit with a pediatrician who doesn't have specialist training, who doesn't use the evidence-based teacher and home rating scales, doesn't get a thorough history. Diagnosis is serious business. We've got to reimburse careful diagnosis so that we don't under or overdiagnose and we give the right treatments. So this all gets back to your very astute question and point about you've got to sometimes get beneath the surface to figure out what the real meaning of symptoms are.
Dr. Hinstra, you made the point just a few moments ago about the hope that lies within a diagnosis of mental illness and the difficulty with the span between getting treatment, being aware that there's something that might be up and getting treatment. Yep. And so many times you're right, the stigma associated and the shame and the blame associated with the possibility that someone or someone you care about might be dealing with a mental illness really, truly gets in the way of even thinking about accessing mental health care. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I'd like to focus a bit more on that issue.
Great.
Dr. Henshaw, as we talk about the challenge of the lag time between an awareness that something might be up and getting treatment, I'm actually reminded of, unfortunately, more than one occasion in my own office where a parent has come in with a 22-year-old child, college student, who, according to the parent, has all of a sudden begun to manifest unusual behaviors, and they don't want to believe that it's anything other than the stress of college, going through a phase, and maybe too many beers.
People notice themselves that this is happening. And even so, well, everybody else says they feel sad too. Well, what's the matter with you? And so there's shame and stigma involved. But I think what you're talking about is, and it's often in the late teens or early 20s, when a person in college, in the workplace, maybe drifting a bit, the family notices something's really off. The usual interests aren't there. There's a lot of isolation. And it may be that a more severe psychotic form of mental illness is developing. It could be the early signs of schizophrenia. It could be a bipolar episode about to begin or in the early stages. And the family is quite worried, want to get this young adult help. But in such cases like this, one of the symptoms is a lack of insight in that young person. So when Dad was 16 and a half, thinking he was saving the free world from the fascists, he thought the world had the problem. They didn't notice, and he was the savior. He didn't know in those moments that he was fast escalating into a psychotic manic episode. And I think what you're talking about is families now getting desperate. Why won't my young adult, late teen, get help? They don't seem to understand that things are starting to cave. So when we get into these early in the adult years forms of mental illness, it's really hard to get motivation up for treatment because that young adult may not recognize. They may, again, be externalizing the blame through paranoia or thinking everybody else is treating them poorly and not understand that a mental illness is really on the rise. So what we have today that my dad and his family of origin never had all those decades ago is self-help and advocacy and support groups. There's certain ones for depression. There's ones for bipolar disorder, schizophrenia. A sort of umbrella one is NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, a great nonprofit organization.
They're wonderful, yes.
And that's where families who are groping for answers can get support from families who've been there and done that and been through this. Who are the professionals who really understand in your community what it's like for a young adult to show these symptoms and may not be aware of them? And
what do you say to the family members who, in part, don't want to think about the possibility that there may be a mental illness going on because they were good parents? If their child is having an issue, it must be their fault because they didn't rear them well or they married the wrong person or fill in the blanks. What do you say to those family members?
Well, now you're talking about other aspects of shame and stigma, right? What I've got two answers here, and they're both difficult to talk about. Number one, throughout most of the 20th century, what did the mental health professions themselves say was the cause of serious mental illness? Bad parenting.
Often so mother.
Right. The schizophrenogenic mother, the refrigerator who creates schizophrenia, the refrigerator parents who freeze the child out, never develops attachment bonds, and develops autism. Well, it's shocking now to think that those were the professionally dictated guidelines. Both schizophrenia and autism have a huge genetic liability. On the other hand, it's not all the brain and genes. It's getting treatment, and it's early recognition. And course, maltreatment, abuse and trauma can compound genetic liability. 1 + 1 can start to equal 4. So the environment matters too. Number two, Irving Goffman was a sociologist at Berkeley who wrote the first book on stigma in 1963, a little paperback book. You can get it on Amazon for a quarter. Stigma, Notes on the Development of Spoiled Identity. 100 pages, you can read it in a night. Best book on stigma ever written. He got it because he invited himself to St. Elizabeth's Hospital outside of Washington, D.C., lived there, quote, as a mental patient for a number of months to see what the experience would be like. So he was one of those sociologists, anthropologists with lived experience. He wanted to know what the feeling was like. He invented a term called courtesy stigma. So he was being a little bit sarcastic, tongue-in-cheek. If society bothers to stigmatize a group because of their skin color, religious preference, mental illness, left-handedness in the old days, being adopted, well, it's only common courtesy, he said, for society to stigmatize anybody associated with that individual. Parents, family members, relatives, therapists, researchers in psychiatry and clinical psychology and social work, why, we treat, quote, crazy people. So the shadow of courtesy stigma, anybody linked to the stigmatized group and person now is in the penumbra of stigma too. And this is what family members have to deal with. If only you'd raised your kid right. Yeah, my kid's had a tough time at college too, but he or she seems to be making it. Why can't your family cope? These are the slurs and the slights that families have to deal with. And a lot of families say, it'd be better just to sweep this under the rug and maybe my kid will get better and never have to come out of the closet, so to speak, to admit there's a serious mental illness going on. So my heart goes out to such families. My family of origin was professionally ordered never to raise why Dad would disappear. Dad would be gone for 3, 6, 1 point even 12 months at a time. No one ever said that he was going. I was not allowed to ask where he was when he was gone. And when he came back, there's a scene in the book. I'm sitting at the kitchen table with my sister, and there's Dad. He's been gone for a year. He's cooking scrambled eggs and putting toast in the toaster. It's a warm spring day. He's starting to sweat. We're all warm. Had he been back for a day, a week, a month? Hadn't there been a party or celebration? I started to wonder what was reality myself. Again, the professionally ordered shame and silence and stigma colored my first 18 years when Dad revealed to me, pulling me into his study at home, son, perhaps you should hear some events from my life. Number one, I now had a purpose. I changed my major to psychology. I was going to go into mental health and help kids and families. But number two, because I myself was too ashamed to tell roommates, girlfriends, anybody about what was going on for years until I got support, I believe that I was probably next on line for the schizophrenia Dad had. If I couldn't sleep, if I lay awake all night, I probably end up in mental hospitals myself. Shame and silence are self-perpetuating. If you come out and you can open up in a support group, in a therapy office, friends and colleagues and neighbors, then what happened back in the 30s and 40s? You didn't put cancer in the obituary of your relative who died from it. Cancer was a shameful disease you brought upon yourself by weak moral fiber and personal will. Today, cancer is a cause. Breast cancer, the giant NFL guys are wearing pink knee socks in support of breast cancer 2 or 3 Sundays every fall. Where's the cause for mental health? We're far behind because we still don't talk about it. If we heard the everyday stories of family coping, individuals, not just superheroes, not just John Nash of A Beautiful Mind, who had paranoid schizophrenia and won the Nobel Prize in Economics. In fact, my dad knew John Nash when he was a grad student in Princeton. And not just the homeless people you see on the street. Sometimes we think of people with mental health issues as either superheroes or supervillains. I think what's brought cancer out of the closet is the stories of everyday people and everyday coping. The more stories, as in Another Kind of Madness, my latest book, of our family's stress and coping and finally our mini triumph of getting out of the shame and silence, then the issue wouldn't be buried. It would be on the national agenda.
You know, Stephen, as you're talking about the moment of walking into the kitchen and there's Dad as if he never left. And I just think about all of those secrets that exist in children's families. And they have no idea. I mean, it's almost stunning at this point to kind of wrap one's brain around how much that scrambles an adult brain, let alone a child brain, to try to understand what's going on. I'm not even going to talk about attachment because that's a whole other conversation.
That's a whole other topic.
It's a whole other conversation. Yeah. But to the parents, to the loved ones who are listening to our conversation today, how would you guide them when there is going to be an absence of any kind? I mean, it could be that somebody's going in the hospital overnight for, you know, a surgical procedure. But do we remain silent or do we talk to our children? Do we talk to each other?
We have to talk about it. Now, does that mean that I should have witnessed not just Sunday afternoon at the Willard restaurant, which we led the show with? Do I have to witness Dad's escalation into full-blown mania? No, that's traumatizing to kids. I'm not advocating that people with mental health conditions disclose the first time they meet someone on the street or their first time they're at a job interview. It's all about timing. It's about having support. It's rehearsing. But if the default is you can never talk about it because it's too shameful, that's what gets communities and families into the bad shape we're in. You've got to find words. So I want to talk for a moment about my colleague, William Bill Beardsley, Harvard Medical School, former chief of child psychiatry at Children's Hospital, Boston, who some years back devised a form of family therapy for families in which one or both parents has depression or bipolar disorder. Now, Bill Beardsley is an advocate of communication because he doesn't want the kids to remain enclosed in silence and shame and internalization. So in this 16-week form of family therapy, A, the parents need one-on-one therapy for their own depression and bipolar disorder. They might need medicine. They certainly need talk therapy. But the family part of the therapy is mainly designed to get the parents to talk to the kids about, in my case, it would have been Dad's absences, or maybe it's Mom's secret drinking, or maybe it's the unemployment, or the long periods in bed with the depressions. And the idea is the families often resist, well, why would I talk to my kids about this? It's shameful. It would harm them. And the therapist says, no, we need to find the right words for the ages of your children and the particular language your family uses. There's no script. You don't memorize how to talk to kids about this. You learn the language your kids will understand. The families resist. The kids are out in the playroom part of the sessions, and the therapist promotes the rehearsal. The kids come back in, and the family gradually struggles to find the words. 16 weeks later, at the end of therapy, the kids who get this form of therapy, these are experimental studies, as opposed to those randomly assigned to more traditional family therapy or reading books about depression and mood disorders. The kids are doing better in school. Kids are doing better socially, better self-esteem. 4 years later, with no further therapy, those kids who've been a part of this therapy have their own risk for depressions cut by 50%. It's not just genes that transmit serious mental illness. It's the lack of communication and the silence. And to me, this is powerful evidence that, again, you don't just make stuff up and you don't expose kids to a parent's serious substance abuse or psychotic behavior, but kids know something's going on. And if you can find the right words in the right language to talk to kids about it, the kids don't internalize, and they now have a narrative. They know that there's a hospitalization, or yeah, the police had to come if the dad's behavior got too disturbed, but they can talk about it. And unlike my case, my fantasies were whatever was going on must be so shameful no one can ever talk about it. It must be the worst thing imaginable. So when you're in that realm of fantasy and thinking it's so shameful it can't even be discussed, it must be so awful that the family will be destroyed. Once you can talk about it, you can do something about it. That's the bottom line.
Dr. Hinshaw, you talked about your dad being away and being in treatment. What kind of treatment was available when your dad would go away?
Boy, in 36, when he was 16 and a half going on 17, he spent 5.5 months in what I think we would today call a snake pit, a public mental facility in Southern California. 2 months in, the superintendent called my grandfather. Hurry down to the facility. So my grandfather had a long drive in his old 1930s-style car, and the superintendent and the medical director there saying, your son just turned 17, still believes that the fascist threat is real. Well, the fascist threat was real, but that he could fight it. And he believes now that the fascists have poisoned the food at the facility. So he stopped eating. He almost went on a hunger strike. Dad was a football player and shot putter, good athlete, admitted at 180 pounds, and he was down to under 120. They were going to call in the minister to deliver last rites that evening. That's the kind of facility he was in. No communication with the family. There were no psychiatric medications at the time. The main treatment he got, as best I can determine, was he was tied to his bed at night so he wouldn't wander. Somehow he started to come to his senses. The delusion cleared. He regained his weight, and a few months later was sent home one weekend because he was suddenly better. That's the way bipolar disorder can work. In later hospitalizations after Princeton, he was at Philadelphia State Hospital at Byberry, the sort of district outside Philadelphia where the facility was located. He didn't know at the time. It was known as the worst public mental hospital in the U.S. In one of the men's dorms, there were 7,000 men in a space for 1,500. Conscientious objectors who would be placed there rather than going overseas to fight in World War II smuggled out photographs. There were regular beatings and deaths. The photographs of the men's units looked like the photographs of Dachau or Buchenwald. They looked like the concentration camps. When Dad was there, he had the delusion that he was in a concentration camp in Germany. Now, you could say that was, quote, crazy, delusional. In some ways, it wasn't far off from the truth. In later hospitalizations, Dad got antipsychotic medications that were over from France. He was the fourth person in the U.S. to get Thorazine in 53, just shipped over from France. He got a lot of electroconvulsive therapy, shock treatments. Now, electroconvulsive therapy can be very helpful for people with severe depression. But back in the day, they were used indiscriminately, and the anesthetics weren't right, and they were used punitively. Until I diagnosed Dad correctly with bipolar disorder coming out of college, after Dad and I would have 3 or 4 talks a year when I'd go back to Columbus, he didn't get on lithium and other mood stabilizing medications. He had 40 years of the wrong treatments in the wrong snake pit mental facilities. We have evidence-based treatments today that can work if people can get access to them. It's about healthcare, it's about parity, it's about shame and silence and stigma. If we can overcome these kind of barbaric attitudes that you can never discuss mental illness, it's too shameful, and people can get access to care, we can turn the corner. But until we do that, we're still in the dark ages.
Absolutely. Dr. Hinshaw, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue.
Thank you.
Dr. Henshaw, again, there's so much fear and stigma, as we have been saying repeatedly, around the issue of mental illness. I think about the person who knows that they have a parent who has been diagnosed with fill in the blanks. And now they're afraid that either they too will have whatever their parent has. They don't want to tell someone they're in a relationship with for fear that any children they may have will have fill in the blanks. What do we do with all of this?
Oh, boy. Let me count the ways. It's such a good question. I said a few moments ago that you didn't put cancer in the obituary of your relative not that many decades ago in our country, and now it's a cause. HIV, AIDS, in the early days of the epidemic, you'd never admit it. It was shameful. You brought it upon yourself through your sexual orientation or drug use or getting the wrong blood supply if you had hemophilia. And cancer, we don't have full cures yet, but we can treat it better and earlier. HIV, we can have long lifespans for people with early detection and the right treatments. We can do the same for mental health conditions now, but people don't get access to care. Again, insurance is part of the issue. Shame and embarrassment is part of the issue. Lack of providers out there with knowledge of evidence-based treatments. I think stigma is huge for conditions that are still ensnared in mystery. We don't know much about mental illness. Maybe it's evil spirits. Maybe it's the curse of the father visited upon the son. Once we demystify and say, these are illnesses, they're brain illnesses, other factors, again, like child rearing and maltreatment in particular, can add to the mix, but they're not the total cause. Let's be matter of fact. If you treat, you can get people to recover from symptoms and have far better lives. The way if you treat cancer, the way if you treat HIV, in some ways, we're still back in the dark ages of the biblical descriptions of mental illness. If you want good descriptions of mental illness, go to the Bible or Quran. I mean, this is, people started recording human history. They recorded sometimes these mysterious symptoms. They're less mysterious every decade as we know more of the brain science and we know more of the environmental triggers. We just have to, and I mean, it sounds very simple, not take it in terms of having to keep silent. Once Dad disobeyed the doctor's orders and talked to me, I turned my life around, got on the track of getting into the field of mental health and fighting stigma myself. If we can just put words to it, and if we can say, these are treatable conditions, yeah, sometimes the symptoms are hard. Mental illness can wreak havoc on families. Early autism, post-traumatic stress disorder, bipolar illness. I could go through the whole catalog in the DSM of all the various diagnoses. But what they have in common is they're nameable and treatable. The brain science, the neuroscience, the psychological science is growing every year. But we still fund mental health research at lower levels than so-called physical health because we still don't think it deserves it. So getting it on the national agenda, this is a local, it's a bottom-up grassroots movement. This is where the advocacy and self-help groups are so important. If we talk about it, just as with cancer, the policymakers can't ignore it any longer.
Talk about the work of Glenn Close with the Bring Change to Mind effort.
I gave a lecture 5 springs ago at Berkeley to my big undergraduate class on developmental psychopathology. We talk about genes and environments and temperament and attachment and autism and ADHD from A to Z, all the categories of child and adolescent mental illness. And so the lecture was done. I was walking across campus to the gym to play basketball, take a nice noon break. My phone rang. It was a 212 area code. I thought, who's calling me from New York? And I picked up, and the caller said that she was Glenn Close and wanted to talk to Stephen Henshaw. I thought, now who's punking me, right? This can't be true. And I said, Ms. Close? And she said, yeah, this is Glenn. She said, I've read about your work in mental health and in anti-stigma efforts. I formed a group called Bring Change to Mind. We're going to fight stigma through public service announcements and advertisements, and we're going to work with young people the way you're doing in some of your work. And so we happened to both be in Los Angeles a month later and spoke at mutual events, and we're on some media together. And so I'm proud to be a scientific advisor now to Bring Change to Mind. There's a big college program at Indiana University called U, the letter U, Bring Change to Mind, University Bring Change to Mind, where 4 years of Indiana University students are working to fight stigma. I do the most direct work, and let's bring change to mind. Let's erase the stigma, L-E-T-S. These are high school clubs. They're not mental health groups. These are clubs. You go to club week at a high school. You can join the chess club or the rugby club or the Latin club, if there's still any Latin clubs left. Or you could join the Let's club. And there, one of your teachers is the advisor. We've provided a guidebook, not a script. It's not a bunch of lessons on learning the symptoms of depression or schizophrenia. It's a way for kids in the high school years to channel their own empathy and activism to find ways in their communities to talk about the issues and fight stigma. We have found in a couple of different evaluations, one published, another we hope to publish, just got the data in, that when kids join these clubs, well, they're already motivated to fight stigma and talk about mental health issues. But being part of this group, this activist group of kids who really want to change the world in this way, you learn a little bit more about mental health, but your attitudes change more radically, and you don't want to keep as distant from people with mental health conditions. We have changed in our country attitudes towards some key issues, like gay marriage, for example, very radically in the last 15 years. This has been driven not by people my age, but by young people. I think with mental health, the trick and the secret, the ingredient is if we can get young people's activism and empathy engaged in a generation or two, we'll look back and say, can you believe we treated mental health the way we did back in the day? Just the way we've changed our attitudes about cancer. And I think young people are the wave of the future.
You know, it's fascinating to hear about the work that you're doing in the high schools. That just sounds remarkable.
Yeah. It's high school kids. I mean, what happens today? Social media, which we know can be problematic and wonderful. Kids, YouTube, getting to know other people online around the world who are struggling with the issues that they themselves or their family members or best friends are struggling with. There's instant communication. There's ways to forge links across generations and across people in different locations. And the clubs, you get a group of kids together that don't want their mom's or dad's depression or their own struggles with eating or anxiety to be buried anymore. And they're finding ways to get school assemblies. They're finding ways to get speakers into their clubs and their schools to talk about these issues firsthand. This is the kind of grassroots young people community action that I'm convinced, if it's like a snowball effect, if we can keep this going, our society won't in the future tolerate the shame and silence and stigma any longer.
And the high school clubs, they're the Let's clubs, L-E-T-S?
L-E-T-S, Let's Erase the Stigma. So we're in California now. We've got 100 clubs starting in the fall of 2017 in the Bay Area and some clubs in Los Angeles. And as we can get the funds and we can get the networking to scale up, this would be a great movement to take national.
That is just so important and so extraordinary.
Well, we think that, and there's a lot of groups out there. Bring Change to Mind is the one that I'm spending a lot of time with these days, in addition to my research at UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco. We can't afford to have mental health issues languish in silence any longer. We're not going to take it anymore. I'm telling my story and another kind of madness. Many more people are coming out of the closet, so to speak, with their stories. The more stories that are told, statistics are important. I could tell you that one family in three in the United States is dealing with moderate to severe mental illness, and that's true. That's a shocking statistic. It's not rare. But what's going to convince you more, I think, is hearing the story of the shame and silence our family went through and how I learned to overcome that. Stories and narratives, the emotion behind that changes people's minds more than every statistic in the world.
Absolutely. And, you know, the other benefit I would say to the work that you're doing, particularly around the high schools, I could see it having a significant impact on reducing bullying in the schools.
Well, this is a big issue, too, that we know that the effective interventions for school bullying aren't just treating a bully or two at a time. These are school interventions where there's a different norm set and limit set and the communities involved. And it's not just mental health issues. It's bullying issues. It's sexual orientation issues. It's, look, I can be very glib for a minute and tell you I could solve racial prejudice and stigma. Well, how, you ask, Dr. Hinshaw? Well, everybody just changed their skin color to mine. Well, that's, I'm being sarcastic, of course. We have to accept difference religiously, skin color, many human differences. With mental health, though, it works two ways. Yes, we have to be more accepting that people don't all behave the same. But also, mental health conditions are mental illnesses. When people get treatment, that's one of the most potent stigma reducers, because then they're able to take charge of their lives. And so the Let's clubs in high schools, the self-help and support groups have a dual purpose: to get people more tolerant of a range of behaviors and emotions that people express, but also to motivate kids and adults and families to get mental health treatment for their loved ones, because that's going to be a stigma reducer as well.
The idea of seeing a therapist, you talk about your own experience of seeing a therapist. And we know that there are still, although I believe it's much less so, there are still areas and families in which, and individuals in which, the idea of seeing a therapist all by itself brings up a sense of shame. There's a stigma attached to it. Can you speak to that issue for a moment?
Well, let's just think of the language. Are you going to go see a shrink?
Right.
What does that mean? You're going to go see a head shrinker, right? Is it a witch doctor? Are these real doctors? And we talked about courtesy stigma a few minutes ago, associated stigma. Your clinical psychologists are valued less than neuroscientists or social or developmental psychologists. Psychiatry's low on the totem pole, if you will, of prestige, not like being a surgeon, right? All mental health professionals are dealing, by definition, with people with mental health conditions. The professionals themselves are somewhat stigmatized. There's still an aura of mystery. You mean you'd take a pill to control your brain? Well, that seems crazy, to use another stigmatizing word. Or you can't work out problems by yourself. I think this is a big part of it. We tend to have this almost puritanical attitude that, hey, look, I've had down days too, and I'm struggling. I toughed it out. Why can't you? Well, we know that mental health conditions, even though in the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, there's categories of depression and bipolar disorder, but these are actually spectrum conditions. We used to think you either had bipolar disorder or you didn't, but there's bipolar type 1 or type 2 or cyclothymia. There's gradations of depression. There's even gradations of schizophrenia. Where do you fall on the continuum? Is your blood pressure a little bit too high, or are you markedly in the hypertension range? The more we understand that, we're all vulnerable. And through the luck of the genetic draw and other toxic chemicals, other environments that you grew up in might also potentiate that risk. If we could understand that everybody's at risk at some level. Some people have several risk markers. they go into the more severe category. Seeing a therapist isn't a mark of weakness, it's a mark of strength. Now you're going to learn coping strategies that you might not have gotten otherwise. Sometimes medications need to get in the mix. These aren't poisons for the brain. Again, they're not cures. Some of them have side effects. What do we know for almost every form of mental health condition? On the severe end, the best effects come from combinations of medication and individual or group or family therapy and support. It's not just the brain. It's not just the social network. It's both coming together. And if we can destigmatize seeing a shrink and getting treatment, that'll be a long step towards eradicating the stigma.
Dr. Henshaw, where can listeners find out more about the work you've done and what you're continuing to do?
So I'll have a couple of answers. I'm an easy email target, if you will. My last name, Henshaw, H-I-N, as in Nancy, S-H-A-W, at Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y, three E's in Berkeley, .edu. My author website is www.stephenhinshawauthor.com, and that's Stephen with a P-H, S-T-E-P-H-E-N, H-I-N-S-H-A-W, author.com. And all of my books, including Another Kind of Madness, my most recent, are there. Send me an email, Google me, Stephen Hinshaw with a P-H, and you'll see some of the talks and lectures I've given and some of the articles and books I've written. I'm eager to get people in touch with other people, with existing self-help and support groups out there, local community networks. The answer to stigma is policy, mental health parity, taking away discriminatory legislation. You still can't vote or run for office or drive if you admit a mental illness in many states. But it's also changing the media images we have out there, and it's getting people to open up about their experiences. I think the bottom up, the grassroots opening up, may be the most important of all.
Dr. Henshaw, I couldn't agree with you more. Thank you so much for spending time with us today and discussing this very, very important issue.
Well, your questions were probing, and I could talk for a few more hours, as you can tell, but it's been a delight to be on. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational opportunity. It is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. I would love to hear from you. Pamela at mindtalk.org is my email address. That's P-A-M-E-L-A at mindtalk.org. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. You take care.